Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 676, Sedition Part 2, Target America. This program is being recorded on June 14th of the year 2009. For a number of years, specifically beginning in the late spring of 2006, I've been talking about various movements to use ethnic groups and various other stratagems to break up large countries. I've spoken at great length about the UNPO, the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, headed up by Karl von Habsburg, the heir to the House of Habsburg, the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, married, by the way, to Francesca Thyssen-Bornemisza, heiress to the Thyssen fortune as well, to which the Third Reich and the Bush family were deeply connected. I've spoken about the use of various ethnic groups to break up large countries. The UNPO has backed the Tibetans and the Uyghurs, both working to fragment China. Not incidentally, Xinjiang province, and I'm mispronouncing that, in China, is very, very rich in, surprise, surprise, fossil fuels. The Uyghurs are Muslim and have a history of association with enemies of China. Also among the groups being championed by the UNPO are the Lakota in the United States, who have already declared independence up to a point, and the territory that they claim in the U.S. as their sovereign nation is also, surprise, surprise, rich in fossil fuels, including oil. The UNPO has championed Alaskan independence. They have championed, to a greater extent, Hawaiian independence. They cite as their greatest success the secession of Kosovo from the Yugoslavian Federation. And they have been championing also, and sort of indicative of the real sentiments of that organization, among the downtrodden, oppressed peoples whom they've been championing are the Afrikaners, who rule the apartheid fascist government of South Africa. And I've also spoken about, again, the alliances between some of those groups, such as the Hawaiian Independence Movement and the Lakota, the UNPO, and other secessionist movements here in the United States. The Middlebury Institute, which aims to have Vermont secede from the United States, in particular the League of the South, which aims for a new secessionist confederacy, and the Alaskan Independence Party, for which Sarah Palin is something of a cat's paw. I've been speaking about what might very well take place, namely a breakup of the United States in the event of an economic collapse. Of course, nothing like that has happened, has it? And I can appreciate that many members of the listening audience may have thought that I was, you know, off the wall, crazy, what have you. Well, again, now we're starting to see those calls. Sarah Palin is a front for an organization looking to have Alaska secede. As we're going to see later, Governor Rick Perry of Texas refused to rule out Texas seceding from the Union when that subject was broached by, among others, martial artist and movie star Chuck Norris. Well, for those of you who, and I can appreciate this, this is not meant in any way to be arrogant, for those of you who might have thought this was completely off the wall and, you know, there goes Dave again talking about stuff that just isn't going to happen, blobbity blobbity blob. Well, check this out. A long, very scary op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal from Saturday, June 13th of 2009. This op-ed piece is by Paul Starobin, S-T-A-R-O-B-I-N. It's called Divided We Stand. And it is talking in an advocacy sense about a breakup of the United States. This reads, remember that classic Beatles riff of the 1960s? You say you want a revolution? Imagine this instead, a devolution. Picture an America that is run not as now by a top-heavy Washington autocracy, but in freewheeling style by an assemblage of largely autonomous regional republics reflecting the eclectic economic and cultural character of the society. There might be an austere Republic of New England with a natural strength in higher education and technology, a Caribbean-flavored city-state Republic of Greater Miami with an anchor in the Latin American economy, and maybe even a Republic of Las Vegas with unfettered license to pursue its ambitions as a global gambling, entertainment, and conventioneer destination. California? America's broke, ill-governed, and way too big nation-like state might be saved, truly saved, not by an emergency federal bailout, but by a merciful carve-up into a trio of republics that would rely on their own ingenuity in making their connections to the wider world. And while we're at it, let's make this project binational. Economic logic suggests a natural multilingual combination between Greater San Diego and Mexico's northern Baja, and to the Pacific North between Seattle and Vancouver in a mega-region already dubbed Cascadia by economic cartographers. Devolved America is a vision faithful to both to certain post-industrial realities as well as to the pluralistic heart of the American political tradition, a tradition that has been betrayed by the creeping centralization of power in Washington over the decades, but may yet reassert itself as an animating spirit for the future. Consider this proposition. America of the 21st century, propelled by currents of modernity that tend to favor the little over the big, may trace a long circle back to the original small government ideas of the American experiment. The present-day American Goliath may turn out to be a freak of a waning age of politics and economics as conducted on a supersized scale, too large to make any rational sense in an emerging age of personal empowerment that harks back to the era of the yeoman farmer of America's early days. The society may find blessed new life, as paradoxical as this may sound, in a return to a smaller form. This perspective may seem especially fanciful at a time when the political tides all seem to be running in the opposite direction. In the midst of economic troubles, an aggrandizing Washington is gathering even more power in its hands. The Obama administration, while considering replacing top executives at Citigroup, is newly appointing a compensation czar with powers to determine the retirement packages of executives at firms accepting federal financial bailout funds. President Obama has deemed it wise for the U.S. Treasury to take a majority ownership in General Motors in a last-ditch effort to revive this industrial-age brontosaurus. Even the Supreme Court is getting in on the act. A ruling this past week awarded federal judges powers to set the standards by which judges for state courts may recuse themselves from cases. All this adds up to a federal power grab that might even make FDR's New Dealers blush. But that's just the point. Not surprisingly, a lot of folks in the land of Jefferson are taking a stand against an approach that stands to make an indebted citizenry yet more dependent on an already immense federal power. The backlash already underway is a prime stimulus for a neo-secessionist movement, the most extreme manifestation of a broader push for some form of devolution. In April, at an anti-tax tea party held in Austin, Governor Rick Perry of Texas had his speech interrupted by cries of "secede," unquote. The governor did not sound inclined to disagree. "Texas is a unique place," he later told reporters attending the rally. "When we came into the Union in 1845, one of the issues was that we would be able to leave if we decided to do that." Such sentiments resonate beyond the libertarian fringe. The Daily Kos, a liberal website, recently asked Perry's fellow Texas Republicans, "Do you think Texas would be better off as an independent nation or as part of the United States of America?" It was an even split, 48% for the U.S., 48% for a sovereign Texas, 4% not sure. Amongst all Texans, more than a third, 35%, said an independent Texas would be better. The Texas Nationalist Movement claims that over 250,000 Texans have signed a form affirming the organization's goal of a Texas nation. Secessionist feelings also percolate in Alaska, where Todd Palin, husband of Governor Sarah Palin, was once a registered member of the Alaska Independence Party. But it is not as if the right has a lock on this issue. Vermont, the seat of one of the most vibrant secessionist movements, is among the country's most politically liberal places. Vermonters are especially upset about Imperial America's foreign excursions in hazardous places like Iraq. The philosophical tie that binds these otherwise odd bedfellows is belief in the birthright of Americans to run their own affairs free from centralized control. Their hallowed parchment is Jefferson's Declaration of Independence on behalf of the original 13 British colonies penned in 1776, 11 years before the framers of the Constitution gathered for their convention in Philadelphia. The right of secession precedes the Constitution. The United States was born out of secession, unquote. Daniel Miller, leader of the Texas Nationalist Movement, put it to me. Take that, King Obama. Today's devolutionists of all stripes can trace their pedigree to the anti-federalists, unquote, who opposed the compact that came out of Philadelphia as a bad bargain that gave too much power to the center at the expense of the limbs. Some of America's most vigorous and learned minds were in the anti-federalist camp. Their ranks included Virginia's Patrick Henry of Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death renown. The sainted Jefferson, who was serving as a diplomat in Paris during the convention, is these days claimed by secessionists as a kindred anti-federal spirit, even if he did go on to serve two terms as president. The anti-federalists lost their battle, but history in certain respects has redeemed their vision, for they anticipated how many Americans have come to feel about their nation's seat of federal power. Quote, "This city and the government of it must indubitably take their tone from the character of the men who, from the nature of its situation and institution, must collect there," unquote, the anti-federalist pamphleteer known only as the Federal Farmer wrote. Again quoting, "If we expect it will have any sincere attachments to simple and frugal republicanism, to that liberty and mild government which is dear to the laborious part of a free people, we most assuredly deceive ourselves," unquote. In the mid-19th century, the anti-federalist impulse took a dark turn, attaching itself to the cause of the Confederacy, which was formed by the unilateral secession of 13 southern states over the bloody issue of slavery. Lincoln had no choice but to go to war to preserve the Union, and ever since, anti-federalism in almost any guise has had to defend itself from the charge of being anti-modern and indeed retrograde. But nearly a century and a half has passed since Johnny Rebel whooped for the last time. Slavery is dead, and so too is the large-scale industrial economy that the Yankees embraced as their path to victory over the South and to global prosperity. The model lasted a long time, to be sure, surviving all the way through the New Deal and the first several decades of the post-World War II era, coming a cropper at the tail end of the 1960s, just as the economist John Kenneth Galbraith was holding out, quote, the new industrial state, unquote, the master-planned economy as a seemingly permanent condition of modern life. Not quite. In a globalized economy transformed by technological innovations hatched by happily unguided entrepreneurs, history seems to be driving one nail after another into the coffin of the big, which is why the Obama planners and their ilk, even if they now ride high, may be doomed to fail. No one anymore expects the best ideas to come from the biggest actors in the economy, so should anyone expect the best thinking to be done by the whales of the political world? A notable prophet for a coming age of smallness was the diplomat and historian George Kennan, a steward of the American century with an uncanny ability to see past the seemingly frozen geopolitical arrangements of the day. Kennan, or actually, I believe most people pronounce this Kennan, K-E-N-N-N, K-E-N-N-A-N. Kennan always believed that Soviet power would, quote, run its course, unquote, as he predicted back in 1951, just as the Cold War was getting underway and again shortly after the Soviet Union collapsed. He suggested that a similar fate might await the United States. America has become a, quote, monster country, unquote, affected by a swollen bureaucracy and the hubris of inordinate size, unquote, he wrote in his 1993 book, Around the Cragged Hill, A Personal and Political Philosophy. Things might work better, he suggested, if the nation was, quote, decentralized into something like a dozen constituent republics, absorbing not only the powers of the existing states, but a considerable part of those of the present federal establishment, unquote. Kennan's genius was to foresee that matters might take on an organic, a bottom-up life of their own, especially in a society as dynamic and creative as America. His spirit, the spirit of an anti-federalist modernist, can be glimpsed in an intriguing, quote, mega-region, unquote, initiative encompassing Greater San Diego County, next-door Imperial County, and to the immediate south of the U.S. border, northern Baja, Mexico. Elected officials representing all three participating areas recently unveiled Cali Baja, a binational mega-region, as the, quote, international marketing brand, unquote, for the project. The idea is to create a global economic powerhouse by combining San Diego's proven abilities in scientific research and development with Imperial County's abundance of inexpensive land and availability of water rights, and Northern Baja's manufacturing base, low labor costs, and ability to supply the San Diego area with electricity during peak use terms. Bilingualism, too, is a key, with the aim for all children on both sides of the border to be fluent in both English and Spanish. The project director is Christina Loon, a Kansas native historian and former staffer on the National Security Council in Ronald Reagan's White House in the mid-1980s. Contemporary America as a unit of big governance may be too big. Even the perpetually troubled state of California may be too big, she told me, by way of saying that the political and economic future may belong to the mega regions of the planet. Her conviction is that large systems tend not to endure, quote, they break apart, there's chaos, and at some point, new things form, she said. The notion that small is better and even inevitable no doubt has some flavor of romance, even amounting to a kind of modern secular faith, girded by a raft of multidisciplinary literature that may or may not be relevant. Loon takes her philosophical, by the way, that's spelled L-U-H-N, not L-O-O-N, although that does suggest itself. Loon, L-U-H-N, takes her philosophical cue not only from Kennan, but also from the science writer and physicist M. Mitchell Waldrop, author of Complexity, The Emerging Science at the Edge of Order and Chaos. Even for the hard-edged secessionist crowd, with their rapt attentiveness to America's roots, popular texts in the future trend genre mingle in their minds with the yellowed scrolls of the Anti-Federalists. The cornerstone of my thought, Daniel Miller of the Texas Nationalist Movement told me, is John Nesbitt's 1995 bestseller Global Paradox, which celebrates the entrepreneurial ethos in posting that, quote, the bigger the world economy, the more powerful its smallest players, unquote. More convincingly, the proposition that small trumps big is passing tests in real-life political and economic laboratories. For example, the U.S. ranked 8th in a survey of global innovation leadership released in March by the Boston Consulting Group and the National Association of Manufacturers, with top rankings dominated by small countries led by the city-state Republic of Singapore. The Thunderbird School of Global Management, based in Arizona, has called Singapore, quote, the most future-oriented country in the world, unquote. Historians can point to the spectacularly inventive city-states of Renaissance Italy as an example of the small truly making the beautiful. How, though, to get from big to small? Secessionists like Texas Miller pledge a commitment to peaceful methods. History suggests skepticism on this score. Even the American Republic was born in a violent revolution. These days, the Russian professor Igor Panarin, P-A-N-A-R-I-N, a former KGB analyst, has snagged publicity with his dystopian prediction of civil strife in a dismembered America whose jagged parts fall prey to foreign powers, including Canada, Mexico, and, in the case of Alaska, Russia, naturally. Parenthetically, I would not rule out perhaps Japanese and perhaps Chinese capital funding Russian development of Alaska by Russian oil interests. And if the Alaskans should decide not to go along with that, well, Yakuza ninja assassins and perhaps ex-Spetsnaz Soviet special forces people working now for organized crime syndicates, the very powerful and deadly Russian mafias, I got a hunch that they will change the thinking and behavior of those Alaskans who might not go along with that. Of course, maybe Alaskans might want to stick with the Union rather than become a Russian or Japanese or Chinese colony or something of a combination of those. Continuing. Still, the precedent for any breakup of today's America is not necessarily the one set by the musket-bearing colonists demanded. Excuse me. Still, beginning again here. Still, the precedent for any breakup of today's America is not necessarily the one set by the musket-bearing colonists' demanded departure from the British crown in the late 18th century or by the crisis-ridden dissolution of the USSR at the end of the 20th. Every empire, every too-big thing fragments or shrinks according to its own unique character and to the age of history to which it belongs. The most hopeful prospect for the USA, should the decentralization impulse prove irresistible, is for Americans to draw on their natural inventiveness and democratic tradition by patenting a formula for getting the job done in a gradual and cooperative way. In so doing, geopolitical history and perhaps even a path for others might be made, for the problem of bigness vexes political leviathans everywhere. In India, with its 1.2 billion people, there is an active discussion of whether things might work better if the nation-state was chopped up into 10 or so large city-states with broad writs of autonomy from New Delhi. Devolution may likewise be the future for the European continent, think Catalonia, and for the British Isles. Scotland, a leading source of Enlightenment ideas for America's founding fathers, now has its own flourishing independence movement. Even China, held together by an aging autocracy, may not be able to resist the drift towards the smallest. So why not America as the global leader of a devolution? America's return to its origins, to its type, could turn out to be an act of creative political destruction with, quote, we the people, unquote, the better for it. Well, there is so much to think about there that to comment on. Let's start here, since we're talking about California. Big old country, sort of a state, but it is kind of a country. It isn't working because Californians haven't made it work. They passed Proposition 13 in the late 70s. That's now bankrupting the state. It's interesting to see a former Reagan staffer proposing a confederation of parts of Greater San Diego with Baja California. They're saying, well, Imperial County has the water. If you know anything about California, Imperial County gets its water from Northern California, and there's a lot of strife over exactly that. Plus, that comes at the expense, the tremendous expense of much of the ecology up here. How that's going to work if that becomes a separate region is anybody's guess. And I'm sure, by the way, that people in Greater San Diego are really going to enjoy being at the prey of the various Mexican drug cartels, which are literally wreaking havoc right across the border. I'm sure they're going to enjoy that a whole lot. Also, bear in mind that she's a Reagan White House staffer. Not only did Helena von Dahm, protege of SS officer Otto von Bolschwing, create the list from which the Reagan White House was staffed, but one of her top assistants was a guy named Bob Whitaker, who helped with the security clearances for the Reagan administration. Bob Whitaker is an associate of the National Alliance, the top American neo-Nazi group. I would note that the National Alliance's publishing arm, National Vanguard Books, is the publisher of the Turner Diaries and the publisher for Serpent's Walk, which perhaps we'll have time to touch on later. I would also note that the Alaskan Independence Party is very close to the Aryan Nations. It has very strong fascist roots. It's very close to the League of the South, one of the primary secessionist movements, which basically is neo-Confederate and more or less openly racist. There also was reference there to George Kennan. He not only was the architect of much of America's Cold War policy, but George Kennan is also a very, very interesting individual with an utterly reactionary anti-modernist view of the world. By the way, just a brief blurb. It may be that Imperial County gets its water from the Colorado River. I know L.A. and much of Southern California get their water from Northern California. Perhaps Imperial County gets its water from the Colorado. In any event, they don't get it. They don't have their own bloody water. They get it from other parts of the United States. Also, think about this, folks. Suppose something happens like Katrina happens to New Orleans. Who's going to rebuild New Orleans? Or who's going to rebuild the Midwest after the New Madrid Fault? Who's going to rebuild California after the big ones strike here? Who's going to provide unemployment insurance or Social Security or Medicare? I mean, it just, there's so many things that haven't been thought through. But then, you know, Americans don't think through a whole lot of things here. There is a fabulous new book, by the way, about Afghanistan. We're going to be talking about this. It's called Afghanistan's Untold Story by Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould. I'm going to be doing some interviews with the authors. And by the way, people who want to find out about Afghanistan should read this book. It's very short, readable, very, very good, very in-depth, well researched and annotated. But they have this little piece in here about George Kennan. Again, the guy who thinks it'd be great to break up America. In the spring of 2005, Cold War architect George Kennan died at the age of 101. A Washington Post obituary provided an insight into the mind of one of the foremost figures of post-World War II U.S. foreign policy and his antipathy for the modern world. Walter Isaacson and Evan Thomas reported in their book, The Wise Man, that he suggested in an unpublished work that women, blacks, and immigrants be disenfranchised. He deplored the automobile, computers, commercialism, environmental degradation, and other manifestations of modern life. He loathed popular American culture. In his memoirs, he described himself as a guest of one's time and not a member of its household. I certainly do not enjoy environmental degradation or commercialism, but again, this guy is a complete anti-modernist, an anti-Diluvian thinker of the worst sort, and last but certainly not least, a bigot. And when you dig into these various secessionist movements, you find that basically they are fascistic and, to a large extent, staffed by bigots. Something to think about, too, in many of the books, or many of the programs, I should say, in which I've accessed information from the book Serpent's Walk, some of the some of the underground Reich functionaries in that book are talking about the future, and what they're talking about is the mid-21st century, and they're talking about the SS ruling or coming to rule over what is described as a corporocracy, in which the world is run by several giant corporations that pretty much control everything. Well, if the world is broken up into little city-states, then the giant corporations are going to rule without opposition. And also Singapore. Singapore is not a place you want to be, folks. That place is totalitarian with a capital T. And you break wind in public in Singapore, you get hung by your heels. I mean, not literally necessarily, but it is a brutal, authoritarian little city-state, and it isn't any place you would want to find yourselves. It's funny to contemplate people from Vermont and the Middlebury Institute down in Singapore, folks. Let me tell you, they would rethink their thing in a heck of a hurry. But we're going to talk some more about this, and again, probably due to the limits of time, I'm not going to be able to recoup all of the information about secessionism, but various programs about the UNPO, For the Record 550, 652, Palin by comparison, various programs about going native go into this at considerable length. Please use the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com, the best source for information of this kind. And for those of you who don't like what's going on, there's a page to click on in order to support the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like what's going on, there's no better way to resist it than to support the work that I'm doing. And my name's Dave Emery. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 676, Sedition Part 2, Target America. This is being recorded on June 14th of 2009. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.